I've come to believe that happiness for a lot of people, it can be more of a choice than we like to ascribe to it. And if you actively make the effort to be grateful for things, if you write them down, if you acknowledge them, if you say to people, oh, I'm grateful for blank, it produces serotonin. I mean, literally, there's a chemical reaction in your brain.
Will, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Really grateful and honored to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Danny.
I was trying to figure out where a good place to start this conversation might be. And I was doing my research on you, and I found out that one critical thing, one critical habit in your own life was meditation and the role of meditation. That also has transformed my life. So I figured, why not jump off there? I'd love to know, what was Will before meditating versus Will after meditating?
It's a great question. I was 24 years old when I discovered meditation. So this would have been 2013. So I've been meditating now for 10 or 11 years. I was about 2 years into running Whoop. I had raised something in the district of $10 or $15 million. I had a team at that point of probably 20 to 30 people. And I felt like I was spinning out of control. You know, I think on paper, outside in, I think a lot of people would probably admire maybe where I was in life. Wow, he's, you know, young person's raised money. He's chasing his dream of building a company. He's got these employees. But I felt very off balance. I was extremely stressed out. I was really struggling with what it meant to be a CEO. I was drinking kind of an endless amount of caffeine, and it was almost like coffee didn't work. And I wasn't sleeping well. I was drinking too much alcohol. I was kind of spinning out of control. I mean, I don't know if outside in, again, people would have noticed I was spinning out of control, but I knew that I was not solid and I wasn't on good footing. And I had an experience of a panic attack even when I was driving on the highway. And it was a pretty scary experience. I had never had anything like that happen before. I would say most of my teenage years, early 20s, I wouldn't describe anxiety as sort of like a big part of my life. I think I was generally comfortable, and so the idea of experiencing a panic attack was really foreign to me. Anyway, I ended up in the emergency room, and I ended up being shocked to find out that I was there because of a panic attack and stress and anxiety and so whatnot. So,
what was causing it?
I think it was just a combination of all the factors that I just explained, which, you know, I didn't feel comfortable running this company. I had really just put myself in a situation that was kind of past where my maturity level was. And I also hadn't given myself a set of behaviors and tools to deal with it. You know, a big theme of not just building Whoop, but even Whoop the product, is how you develop lifestyle decisions and tools to, you know, live a successful life. And so at that point in time, I wasn't there. And so I really sought out, hey, what would be the first tool I could use to better combat stress? And somehow I landed on transcendental meditation. I ended up taking a 4-day course on it, which I think at the time cost like $900. And I remember thinking was very expensive for where I was in life. But the advantage to doing it was, because it was so expensive, it actually forced me to commit in a way to meditating twice a day. And look, I've been doing it, you know, I've been doing it now for 11 years. I'm happy to talk more about the practice and what it's done for me, but that's how I got into meditating.
I love that. That's a great story. So take us through some of the benefits that you've experienced over the past 10 years.
Well, I'll start just by saying that I think learning to meditate is a superpower. And I would encourage anyone listening to this to try to develop it as a practice. In a way, I look back on hitting sort of this rock bottom, if you will, from an anxiety and stress standpoint as a blessing because it forced me to find this tool. I think a lot of people are kind of, they haven't quite hit this rock bottom. And so they're kind of just going through life uncomfortable, but without tools. And the first sort of thing that meditating did for me was it taught me how to breathe, which sounds like a silly thing. But, you know, when you actually sit still and start breathing through your nose and thinking about breathing deeper versus, you know, inhaling more sharply versus exhaling longer, like you just start to understand how much control you actually have over your autonomic nervous system. The second thing, and this was specific to transcendental meditation where you repeat a mantra, is I'll just describe it for a second because not everyone might know what it is. So, you close your eyes and you start breathing and then you start repeating a mantra to yourself. And what inevitably happens as you start repeating the mantra is thoughts start coming into your mind. I had an argument with so-and-so. Oh, I'm nervous about this meeting. Oh, what about my girlfriend? Oh, you know, these are the types of things that come into your mind. And it's sort of the general chaos of your brain. And that gives you this sort of moment in time to decide whether or not you want to think about the thought that's just come into your mind or whether you want to go back to the mantra. Now, just that decision that I just explained of thinking about a thought versus repeating a mantra all of a sudden creates for you a sorting mechanism of your thoughts. And it's not like you're deliberately trying to sort your thoughts, but you start to realize that you actually can deliberately sort your thoughts just through that one interaction of, am I going to go back to the mantra or am I going to think about the thought? And what this practice does for you over time is it makes you realize that you have essentially a third person bird's eye view to not just your thoughts, but your feelings and your emotions. And the difference between doing this for a few weeks versus a few years or a decade is you start to realize that that third person is with you all the time. And so, you know, today, going back to 23-year-old Will or 24-year-old Will, you know, I might find myself in a situation where I'm yelling or I'm upset about something. And it's almost like, whoa, that escalated. And you're trying to catch up to yourself. You're trying to like catch up to your emotion. And on the flip side, today I feel more like there's a third person who is going to whisper in my ear before I get angry, oh, Will is about to get angry, or Will's frustrated, or, you know, and so then in a way it becomes a decision. Oh, do I want to get angry? You know, is that the right path here? You know, and that's a crazy thing to say, but it just makes you feel so much more in control of yourself. And again, I attribute a lot of that to the practice of meditating. The last thing I would say, and again, I think this is from doing it for a longer time frame, is as you get more comfortable with meditating, you'll find that you can have extremely creative moments. You can have, you know, some problem that you are wrestling with, all of a sudden the answer to it comes to you. Some solution that you needed for how you were going to have certain people work together or how you were going to be able to make two meetings happen on the same day, or it just all of a sudden you come up with these solutions. You don't quite know where it came from. And it, look, it's a beautiful thing. So, you know, if people can't tell, I'm a big endorser of finding a meditation practice. I do it for 20 minutes every morning. For a long period of time, I did it 20 minutes twice a day. I would say originally it was very anchored in transcendental meditation. I would say now it's more fluid than that. Like the notion of a mantra almost doesn't exist anymore. So, yeah, I mean, there you have it.
What have you seen in terms of, so that's the data N equals one from Will.
Yeah.
You have the largest study in maybe human history of people's sleep and what it means when they do certain activities. What have you found on meditation improving sleep over the data? And if you don't have that top of mind, since that's a specific stat, what types of things have you seen in the huge data set that you have that are clear signs of like, oh, when people do this, it leads to better sleep in this situation?
Well, one interesting phenomenon with sleep is a lot of things that you do at any point in the day, not just like a couple hours before sleep, but at any point in the day affect how you sleep later that night. And I think this is relevant for meditation because most people wouldn't think, oh, well, if I meditate for 20 minutes this morning, that's going to have any effect on my sleep. But the reality is it does. We find that people who meditate in the morning or even the evening have higher quality sleep and in general have higher heart rate variabilities, which is this lens into your autonomic nervous system. We could spend a lot of time talking about different things that improve sleep. Generally speaking, the bedroom environment that you're in matters a lot. So colder, darker, quieter, higher air quality, those things are all really important. A consistent bedtime and wake time. So going to bed and waking up at exactly the same time actually creates enormous benefits for the quality of your sleep. Certain behaviors that you do within 3 or 4 hours of sleep matter a lot. So when you eat, if you eat too close to bed, typically within less than 3 hours of trying to go to sleep, that'll be negative for your sleep. Alcohol is incredibly negative for your sleep. Hydration is really beneficial for your sleep. So if you're dehydrated, that'll negatively impact your sleep. You may find different supplements can be beneficial. I like to take magnesium and a small dose of melatonin. And then, you know, back to this point about things throughout the day, exercising in the morning, we often see helps sleep in the evening. Sunlight in the morning improves sleep later that day or in the evening. Blue light blocking glasses, even if worn earlier in the day, can often improve sleep in the evening. I like to wear blue light blocking glasses right after I eat dinner. I'll put them on a few hours before bed. And that essentially gives me this get out of jail free card for looking at an iPhone, a TV, an iPad, because all of those things without glasses are producing blue light, which tells your mind to stay awake. So if you're someone who's looking at their phone right up until they go to bed, I highly recommend blue light blocking glasses.
Yeah. Thank you for that sleep performance overview. Yeah, right. Back to the N equals one of Will.
Sure.
What was it like for your sleep the night of you seeing LeBron James wearing your Whoop device for the first time on television?
That was pretty cool. I'm not going to lie. I mean, the thing about starting a company is, you know, it's like cash and belief. Like short of one, you want to have a lot of the other. And you're constantly looking for these moments to inspire you and your team and create that next windfall of belief. And in 2014, 2015, like Whoop didn't really have revenue. We barely had a product. We had 100 people on the product, But it so happened one of them was LeBron James, who, you know, was arguably the best athlete in the world. And he was wearing Whoop on television one night, and I was watching television, and I was like, oh my God, that's a Whoop. So, you know, if it works for him, it can work for millions of people. We're going to build it for millions of people. And there you go. You got your belief, you know, your injection of belief that you need.
Yeah. And I can only imagine that there have been so many of those moments considering Whoop's success year after year, one after another. I'm curious, though, the personal tolls of the struggles of those. Because when you go to a high high, you inevitably – there is an often unseen low low that comes after or in the coming weeks or months that doesn't get covered as strongly because it's a less sexy story a lot of the times. So, yeah. Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. I think that building a business does create really high highs and low lows. But I think it's important for entrepreneurs not to get caught too much on that yo-yo.
Yeah.
And I was guilty of this for many years in building the company, where it wasn't just that I was caught on that yo-yo, but it was even how I perceived my own performance or even my own identity, right? You say to yourself, well, if Whoop's having a great day, I'm having a great day. If Whoop's having a bad day, I'm having a bad day. If Whoop's failing, I'm failing. And that's a pretty unhealthy mindset. It can create a lack of personal identity, because the reality is there's a lot of things that you're doing that actually are independent from your business. And there's certain things that you can control, and you should focus on those and just focus on getting 1% better every day. And the business will probably follow. But lots of things can happen to a business that are completely out of your control. And additionally, you don't want to be caught on this yo-yo of ups and downs. You want to keep a fairly steady hand. And so I've tried to find a relationship with wins and losses that's a little bit more it has a broader perspective on it, which is, hey, are we marching towards the right mission and overall vision for the company, versus trying to get too caught up in that local high or that local low? Because, you know, the next day, okay, you had a good one today. What about tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Who is Will Ahmed without Whoop?
Well, I'm a husband, I'm a son, I'm someone who likes to exercise a lot and play sports. I feel more, I would say, emotionally connected to the world, in part through the process of being entrepreneurial and realizing I can create a business. I would say even in part through learning how to meditate and just sort of generally feeling more grateful to be alive. You know, I would say you strip it all away, I feel very human. I feel incredibly grateful to be alive at this moment in time and to be witnessing all the beauty of humanity and the chaos of innovation. And I find myself incredibly grateful, I would say, for life.
And when was that indication to you that, oh, I feel grateful?
Well, some of this, again, goes back to tools and systems and practices. Like, I very intentionally have learned to be more grateful. And I choose those words carefully. Like, it was a process of learning to be more grateful. You know, you can go through life and really be unobservant of a lot around you. And on the flip side, if you make a very intentional effort to acknowledge things around you that are beautiful, that are great, that are adding value, that are unique, especially people. I mean, you're constantly surrounded by people, people who are adding value to your life. If you can just acknowledge these moments every time they happen, and of course they're happening all the time, your gratitude starts to skyrocket. And the other reason to do this is it makes you naturally much happier. And so along with you better appreciating the world around you, you will be happier. And I've come to believe that happiness for a lot of people, it can be more of a choice than we like to ascribe to it. And if you actively make the effort to be grateful for things, if you write them down, if you acknowledge them, if you say to people, oh, I'm grateful for blank, it produces serotonin. I mean, literally, there's a chemical reaction in your brain. The challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs, and again, I would put myself in this category along the evolution of building a company, is you live on a dopamine system. And this is what the dopamine system feels like. Oh my gosh, if I can get to this next milestone, that's going to be incredible. And the milestone will be raising $10 million, raising $100 million. The business is worth $100 million. The business is worth $1 billion. The business is worth $3 billion. And so you tell yourself, oh, well, God, when that happens, that's the moment. And the interesting thing about a system like that is it actually is quite effective to make it happen. You know, if I said to you, Danny, I'm going to take you to the best restaurant you've ever been to in your fucking life. I mean, this is the restaurant, you know, I would have created a level of expectation that's very high. And you thinking about getting to that destination in turn would produce dopamine. And by the way, in turn would get you there. You'd be like, wow, this is going to be the greatest food experience of my life. Like, I got to show up for this, right?
Especially if you take me.
Yeah. Well, done. We'll do dinner at some point. So you dopamine systems work in that they create dopamine even in the process of thinking you're going to get to this destination. Problem is, of course, when you get to the destination, it's a letdown because you've built up this, you know, inflated sense of value for it. And so what do? You just move the goalpost. You know what? It wasn't a billion. It was 3 billion. That's what I need to be happy. Right. And of course, that you didn't learn your lesson. So a lot of entrepreneurs are actually afraid to get off that system because they think it's going to lead to some like level of complacency. I believe that you can actually couple a system like that with gratitude. And so what you're then doing is firing different chemicals in your brain, dopamine and serotonin. And the consequence is you can still be hard charging and happy.
It's the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And so what do I tell my friends exactly who say, when I hit this marathon time, then I'll be happy? You just got to balance out your serotonin right now with a little more gratitude?
Well, I would be careful saying – I'd be careful framing it that way. I think when this happens, I'll be happy is probably – it's probably not necessarily the right relationship. I think it's good to say this is the goal. This is the milestone. This is the process we're going to go after to get there. Let's set an ambitious goal. Let's be hungry about it. You know, I think the thing just to be careful of is to get too obsessed with the outcome and lose sight of the magic of the process, right? And that's where the gratitude piece comes in, because in order to get from A to B, you're going to have all of these experiences and challenges, and you're going to get punched in the face, and you're going to overcome it. And, you know, there's going to be all of these things, and that's life. And so You know, there's a great Miles Davis quote: "Music is the time between beats." Mm. It's so true, right? Like it's all about the process and how you get there. And so I think it's really important to set ambitious goals for yourself, whether it's business or life or anything else. I just think that the gratitude element of it makes you more obsessed with the process to get there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it reminds me of the Eckhart Tolle quote about enlightenment being the space between thoughts.
Yeah. Great.
It's just like, it's like the same idea expressed in a slightly different way. It's beautiful. So a lot of people might look at you and be like, okay, this guy's meditating. He's well-dressed. He's a good-looking dude. He went to Harvard. He has all the success and everything you could imagine in every facet of everything. What is Will Ahmed struggling with these days? Yeah, that deep breath was good.
Yeah.
And if you would prefer not to say it publicly, since what you're struggling with is often difficult to approach publicly, we can always cut it out later, but I'm just curious personally.
Well, I find that I'm talking about all the things that you need to do, but you're still every day of life in the struggle of it. I mean, I don't want people to think I've got it all figured out. I'm still trying to become the best version of myself. I'm still trying to become a great CEO. I'm still trying to become a great husband. I'm still trying to become a great son. I think why maybe I sound more upbeat about it is that I've grown to embrace the turmoil, you know, the chaos that comes with it. The feeling of life happens for you, not to you, right? If it gets hard, great. You know what I mean? It's about the struggle. It's about finding something inside of you to overcome it. And so with that, I'll just say, like, you know, I do feel like I've got a lot of things that I'm trying to overcome and I'm working against. But I think if there's something I feel more confidently about at this stage of life, it's that I've tried to build some systems and develop some tools to approach it.
You didn't give me a real good answer there, Will. It's fair. I respect the politician-like answer. You know, you... Do you feel like you've had a choice in building this? Or is it something where it feels like you've been chosen to create this product and build this product and build this company without your, like, has it come through you? Or do you feel like you have sovereignty over creating it?
Well, I do believe that you make a choice every day to live your life. And people, I think, get caught on a groove and all of a sudden think they don't actually have the enormous autonomy they have. I mean, it is a choice every day to show up for work. It's a choice every day to be in your marriage. It's a choice or your relationship. You know, I do feel that way probably in a stronger sense than most people do. Having said that, there's a lot of characteristics to Whoop that have felt somewhat inevitable. And that's a harder thing to explain. I've had a very strong belief system in building the company. So it's hard to separate how much of that was a decision of being really intentional about what we were building. And no, like it coming from a place of true knowing and pulling it forwards.
Yeah, because I look at something like the light bulb, or I look at something like the inventions that happen at different places in the world simultaneously. Hmm. And it's just like, this thing was supposed to come online to the human consciousness at this time. and it was going to happen. It was inevitable. And so those people were the people who created it, were the people who were chosen in some sense to carry out that invention, but it was going to get done either way. It almost feels that way about the wearable movement, about the sleep movement. It almost feels like someone was going to create this. Someone was going to build it. It would have gotten done some way. Do you feel that as well from being in it, or is that just an outside perspective?
Well, I don't know that Whoop would have existed in its current form. Like, sure. I do think that entrepreneurs can create a certain version of their reality, right? Or a certain slice of how they view the world. And look, I think there may have been different wearable products or other products that would have come to the market that might have had a different form. But I'm not certain that this exact version of this company would exist had it not been started, you know? And I say that also because I view the differentiation of Whoop is a lot of things in one. The light bulb, in a sense, is a little bit of an easier thing to describe. Whereas what makes Whoop work is this coordination across six or seven different things, whether it's hardware or software or analytics or design or branding. I think most companies or products can be successful by being like exceptionally great at one or two things. I think the challenge for building anything in the wearables space is that you actually have to be great at like five or six things to have a chance. And some of that's because you're wearing it on your body and it starts to speak to your identity. Some of that's because it's requiring fairly sophisticated data collection and analytics. It's just it ended up being a much more complex problem. And within each one of those layers of problems, you have a variety of different solutions of how you could approach it. And what that means then is that when you look at the overall spectrum of what this company could look like, it's a very wide spectrum of how it could have been built.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's clear that you guys put your unique spin on it. I'm curious from the sense of bringing a problem, you must have every time you come up with a new thing, a new feature, it's like there's a system that you've created to figure out the problem and to solve it in some way. What does that look like from the mind of Will to be like, okay, problem occurs. Now what's the mental model I'm running the framework through when problems occur?
Well, there's two different thought processes going on as you answer this question, or as you were asking this question. The first is like, where does a great idea come from? And when it comes to solving a problem, a great idea often is looking very specifically at a problem and creating an innovative solution for that problem. The thing, though, is once you've already created a platform, you actually get a little bit more leniency for how you think about an idea. And it can actually flip. So it tends to be a real mistake for a company to be a solution in search of a problem. But once you actually have a platform, you can get very creative about different ideas and features that you may want to launch to your audience, in large part because you're intrigued by them. And there's something that makes you want to build them. And like the idea for Whoop was very directly targeting a problem. And the problem was you can't continuously measure your body, and therefore you don't really know how to train. And over time, that problem set got much wider, which is, you know, what is your health and what is your fitness and how come you can't measure these things? But now that Whoop exists and a lot of people are wearing it all the time, I mean, we're often thinking about, well, what are things that could surprise and delight a customer? And it's hard to say whether those things are always solving a problem or whether they're actually some new experience that takes you down this rabbit hole that you otherwise never would have asked for.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so what have been, what's the single feature that you've given people, surprised and delighted, that has filled you with the most joy from building Whoop?
Well, I'll give you one that's been a long time characteristic of Whoop, and it's this idea that you can charge Whoop without ever taking it off. So if you think about the notion of continuously measuring the human body, well, all products have a battery, and that battery life at some point runs out, and so you have to take the product off and plug it into the wall. Well, we said, well, what if you never had to take it off? And that led us down this path of inventing a charger that, you know, essentially looks like a little head that you just slide on top of your sensor, and wearing it for 60 minutes gives you, you know, a battery life of another 5 days. And that's something that people, when they've never heard of Whoop, aren't expecting at all. But when they use it, they're like, oh, this is great.
Little things like that. I love it. When you think of people, who do you look at historically and say to yourself, I am most like this person?
Well, that's a good question. I actually haven't done that mental mapping the way you just described it. I'll tell you biographies and entrepreneurs that I've been inspired by. And I think I acknowledge certain characteristics of them that are similar, or I try to think about how I could embody some of the things that have worked for them. The first is Phil Knight, who wrote a great book called Shoe Dog, which is all about how he created Nike. And in reading the story about Nike, there's this huge focus early on the shoes and this obsession over how do you make running shoes that are more performant than all the other shoes. And, you know, it was like Phil Knight and the guys from Oregon with a waffle iron and trying to create this crazy shoe. And, you know, next thing you know, Prefontaine's running faster in it, and they're kind of off for the races, no pun intended. And so like that for me, his whole arc was a powerful story, and it validated for me some of the approaches that Whoop had taken, namely anchoring ourselves in performance initially, being obsessed with having the best data, not just the best marketing story or the lowest price point or, you know, things that other brands were or companies were pursuing, but really being like a performance product and organically wanting to have the best athletes use it. And then Nike also was a brand that I grew up really idolizing and being affected by, because I was always into sports and exercise, one, but two, it was the first time that I actually could feel a brand. You know, the idea that you wear a white cotton t-shirt versus a white cotton t-shirt with a swoosh, and just the swoosh on it made you feel differently. That to me was a fascinating phenomenon that I felt at a young age and couldn't explain. And so how do you create something like that? How do you create a product or a symbol that then makes people feel differently? You know, that is a phenomenon that has always stuck with me, and I feel is something of a lost art. So anyway, I got a lot from the Nike story and from Phil Knight, who I still admire. When I was 13 years old, I had the first iPod in my whatever, maybe it was sixth grade class or something. Maybe it was 12 or something. But I remember thinking like that the iPod was this unbelievable like unlock of a product. And I thought it was the coolest product. And at the time, my dad, who had worked in finance, wanted me to get interested in stocks. And so he gave me this really small stock portfolio. Or it was like a small amount of money that I could manage for stocks. It was a couple grand, I think. And I put all of it into Apple stock. And so it made a lot of money actually. And it was, it got me interested in technology in a way. It got me fascinated by Apple because I became, you know, this tiny shareholder. And it actually gave me some pocket change when I was starting Whoop. So, you know, the Steve Jobs story became one that, that I became fascinated by, in part because of my relationship to the iPod and in part because of the sort of intuition that he used to guide that company and this, this balance between, what are engineering saying? What are engineers saying is possible versus what's the reality you want to try to pull forwards in the world? And so I there's a lot about his story that I find inspiring. I think much like most entrepreneurs, I think what Elon Musk has done in the last two decades is unbelievable. And, you know, say what you will about his style or him as a person. It's just like you can't argue with the outcomes of SpaceX and Tesla. And I do admire deeply technical companies and also companies that have an intersection of hardware and software. And so, I highly recommend Walter Isaacson's books on both Jobs and Musk.
Yeah. I mean, you could really feel the intersection between Musk, Jobs, and Phil Knight in your own company because you could see the way in which the branding is beautiful, but there's also a focus on software, but also hardware, and also in an attempt to make people live as good of a life as they possibly can while also making a consumer product. Like, it's all there. Like, you could see those influences, but it's cool to hear you detail them out.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I don't know that I've evolved my leadership style or made decisions based on any of those individuals or their companies, but it's more so the appreciation of their work and just how it's made me reflect on the work that I do.
Taking a note from Steve Jobs, didn't you have the engineers code something into the software or something into the hardware and the behind the scenes of it so that people who are trying to copy it could you tell that story?
Yeah, this is a good lesson trying to create a culture around resilience and like, you know, David versus Goliath sort of attitude. In 2018, Whoop was going through a bit of a tough period, if you will. And we met with Amazon about an investment in the company. And we shared a lot of stuff with them that if I did it over again, I wouldn't have shared. And not only did Amazon not invest, 2 years later, they came out with a real copycat product called the Amazon Halo. And it was such a copycat that the lead product manager from Amazon, when he was announcing it on LinkedIn, literally said, "Whoop, there it is," you know, introducing the new. And it's like, wow, that takes some real guts and arrogance to just so aggressively copy a small company. And I got messages from our investors that was a bit of like an RIP, you know, like people were really dejected by Amazon coming out with a copycat product. And for a variety of reasons, I just felt that the product was pretty soulless, and I didn't think the product was going to be successful. And so anyway, that's what I said. But more so than that, we tried to create an energy within Whoop of, well, we're going to beat these guys. And what we did was with our next generation of hardware, we wrote on the circuit board, don't bother copying us, we will win. And, you know, it was something of an affirmation. And every engineer who worked on that product's initials were on the back of the circuit board. And so we all signed up for don't bother copying us, we will win. And the other joke or inside joke with that is if someone's actually able to read that message, they're taking your product apart, which they're probably doing for nefarious reasons. So we kind of loved it internally. And then, you know, sure enough, and fast forward another 3 years, the product got discontinued and failed.
Will and Whoop have the final say. That is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Well, we won that round. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of makings of you to a leader and a someone who you want to fight for and somebody who is willing to stand up for himself if you get bullied by the bigger guy. What were the earliest inclinations or earliest memories you have of being a leader?
Well, I do think an advantage to playing sports is you get put in a team environment, and I captained 3 sports teams in high school. I was captain of the Harvard squash team in college, which was a great experience. I was president of a final club at Harvard. So I had these different experiences of leading people, at least my age. And look, leadership's like anything. You have to develop at it and learn at it, and you make mistakes and evolve. So, you know, I remember the experience of in high school being a captain of a team, and you try to give these like rah-rah speeches, and you know, next thing you know, you find you're like kind of screaming. And, you know, I remember once like my voice cracking, and, you know, like you have these embarrassing moments. And I realized actually in the process of that the screaming piece, it's almost like it's better in tiny doses. And if you want to really instill confidence, you want it to come from a place of calm and inner knowing. Mm. And so that was like, that's one thing that your question maybe just think about is giving like a rally speech as a high school captain versus giving, you know, delivering why we were going to beat Amazon in 2020. Like I wasn't like pounding the table. I wasn't yelling. It was like, hey guys, we have a better product. This is a soulless product. Mm. And we're going to win. And everyone, I think, felt it themselves, but I think they also felt a certain sense of knowing that came with that message. And as a consequence, it was much more impactful, and it was better leadership.
What was the team's reaction to that moment and your leadership style in that moment?
Well, there is an aspect of when disaster strikes, when your competitor does X, Y, and Z, like everyone does look a little bit towards leaders to find what's the appropriate reaction. You have your own reaction, but then you're like, well, how should I be reacting? Let's see what the leadership feels. And so that it is important to carry, to have a point of view on moments of crisis and to be able to, at the very least, have a calm hand, even if you're trying to figure out what to do next. I do remember in that moment immediately feeling like we're going to beat this thing. Like that was my immediate attitude. And it was like, well, a lot of the attributes of the product, I don't know if it's worth going into some of the details about it, but I felt like the product wasn't going to be commercially successful, even with unlimited budget and distribution, because of a lot of the characteristics of how hard the wearable space is. And I also believed in ourselves and kind of all the ground game we had played for 10 years in building the brand with high performance people and athletes and really focusing on data. And I felt that Amazon was trying to manufacture all of that in a really short period of time and essentially trick consumers. And I just believed that consumers were smarter than that. And I believed that we were going to navigate through it. And so even the, you know, putting that thing on the circuit board, it just created a certain sense of energy or confidence or swagger for the organization that people immediately bought into. I think a lot of that energy existed without me saying anything, where people could feel it themselves. Like, hey, we are building something special here. And you want to create that culture on a daily basis, not just when disaster strikes.
Yeah, you can't possibly just manufacture that out of nowhere. It has to be built way before, from the first moment someone comes into the office and they have a feeling that, oh, this thing is special. I want to go back to what you were talking about before with Nike and how when you put on a Nike shirt, you felt different. What exactly is that, and how do you manufacture that in building products?
Well, I think brands are developed through having a strong point of view on the world that may or may not be universally held, and then being incredibly consistent about delivering that feeling or that message. And Just Do It from Nike and the association of Michael Jordan flying through the air and winning and Tiger Woods fist pumping. I mean, it's just, to me, it's the ultimate demonstration of attitude and brand and confidence, and, you know, tight, beautiful ad copy and super desirable marketing ambassadors. And it's, you know, I don't know, you can find a better case study on the development of a brand than Nike. And then, you know, separate from that, I was a customer, right? So I felt all of it going through it. I do think there's an element to building a brand, which means it can turn some people off. People don't talk as much about that side of it, but it's okay to create some polarization. It's okay to have people not like it or have it not resonate. And in a way, that's what's so impressive about the brands of products like Nike and Apple, is that they've been able to build brands while also having a massive, number of people attracted to their products. It's kind of easier to build a brand if you're actually trying to appeal to a smaller number of people, because you can have an even more aggressive point of view on the world, right?
Who have you been comfortable turning away at Whoop?
Turning away in what sense?
In the sense of, we talk about building a brand, it's okay to have a strong point of view and turning away some people.
Yeah, look, our mission has been to unlock human performance. And in the early days, human performance meant the world's best athletes. So it was pretty clear we wanted to work with LeBron. Hey, we didn't even want to work with a high school athlete. Like, you weren't good enough yet for Whoop. And that's just because we didn't have that many products. And that's also because we were catering to the world's smallest market. But over time, even there was a perspective of the brand of being just for elite athletes. And it's some of that carried from the LeBron Phelps era. And then as our product has evolved, human performance has stretched. It's no longer just winning an NBA championship or a gold medal. It's beyond even running a great marathon or doing a CrossFit competition. It's, you know, losing weight. It's getting healthier. It's being a better father. It's a new mother understanding her pregnancy. Like, the definition of human performance has expanded. However, it still occupies a fairly aspirational place. So is Whoop today for someone who's unmotivated? Unmotivated in life, unmotivated regarding their health and fitness? No. Like, I don't think Whoop's a good product for that person. I think that some of our even brand positioning around human performance might turn that person off, you know? So all that's to say, like, you have to pick a specific lane and be exceptional for that. And for most companies, especially at an early stage, if the product and brand is for everybody, it's probably appealing to nobody.
It's beautifully said. And it seems like, you know, from everything I've seen, Whoop has created better humans, and that's a pretty remarkable thing.
So thank you.
Thank you for being you, and thank you for creating a product that seemingly makes the world an incredibly, incredibly better place.